This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest? Are you holding on to secrets, fears, or frustrations? We all carry around different stressors, both big and small. Don't keep it all bottled up inside. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's also a great way to learn to resolve conflict, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/BeHereNow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/BeHereNow.
After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/BeHereNow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
Meditation, you can look at meditation, I compare it to a keyboard. Mm-hmm. And on this keyboard, you have all these different things you can accomplish, okay? If you want to get calm, relaxed, and peaceful, etc. Maybe you want to get clear of focus. Maybe you want to get into silent illumination. Mm-hmm. Maybe you want to get into Rigpa, luminescence, primordial luminescence. Maybe you want to, keep going into investigating reality. And silence is so important. I mean, silent illumination is in many schools of Zen. I mean, they say that's where you're going. That's where we're going to go. That's the destination, is silent illumination.
Hello, friends, and welcome back to the Creativity, Spirituality, and Making a Buck podcast with David Nichtern on the Be Here Now Network. My name is Michael Kammers, your host and monologist, and on behalf of all of us at Be Here Now and Dharma Moon, we sincerely hope this podcast finds you as well as can be, and we are grateful that you are joining us. Here at CSM, our guide, David Nichtern, discusses how to lead an integrated life involving spiritual practice, creative expression, and right livelihood with guests who embody and manifest these principles in their own life. And for this episode, we are very fortunate to have musician, author, teacher, and fellow podcaster Richard Wolf joining us. To set up this episode, I'll relate the tale of how I auspiciously stumbled into Richard's work, share a bit of his background to set the table, and then we'll get right into this delightful discussion. And in the middle there might be a little bit of promo stuff that is very good for everyone to hear. So a few years ago, I was searching on my music app for the songs of an artist that I was working with and saw that this artist was on a podcast called Wolf in Tune, hosted by Richard Wolf. So I gave the podcast a listen and really appreciated the conversation, which mostly was about the musical guest's spiritual journey. Afterwards, I dug into Richard's story a little deeper and couldn't believe that him and David hadn't crossed paths. They have so much in common, both having very deep credentials in the music industry, both teachers of meditation who've written books about mindfulness and creativity. Right up front here at CSM, we are going to wholeheartedly endorse Richard's book, In Tune: Music as the Bridge to Mindfulness, which you will hear more about shortly. So, I hope you can experience the same joy as me hearing these two connecting after sharing so much experience while orbiting around each other, all due to an auspicious internet search a couple years ago. And speaking of the internet and all the digital media we're ceaselessly immersed in, I don't know about you, but in today's attention economy with these highly addictive devices buzzing on our bodies all day, I find it more important than ever to have a practice where I can stabilize my state of being and set aside my ceaseless fixation on scrolling and experience a state of simply being. For me and those of us at Dharma Moon, mindfulness meditation is our foundational practice. It's restorative and enriching and provides me with an essential sense of mental resilience, clarity, and a touch less reactivity, to name but a few things. All that being said, it can be challenging, so it can be good to get some instruction around practice. And so, we invite you to join us for our upcoming Dharma Moon Foundations of Mindfulness program, which will be running 4 consecutive Thursdays starting August 3rd, 2023. And if you're hearing this after the first one of those, you can catch up on the recording and still take part. David will be teaching the program with the assistance of the incredible Stephanie Bellholm. It is a very reasonably priced program and a great way to go deeper and establish a practice with great teachers and a supportive community. I aspire to pop in on a few sessions myself, so I hope to see you there. All these programs and more are listed at www.dharmamoon.com. And I would be remiss in this brief promotional moment if I didn't also mention the Be Here Now Network. We are grateful to be on their platform. If you enjoy this podcast and are interested in engaging with a whole audio library emanating teachings from the world's wisdom traditions, head over to BeHereNowNetwork.com. Personally, I've been listening to Joseph Goldstein's podcast lately, engaging with his incredibly in-depth and clear teachings on the Four Noble Truths and getting a lot out of it. Okay, brief promo moment completed. And now, a brief bio for our guest, Richard Wolff, for context. Richard Wolfie Wolff is an Emmy Award-winning composer, multi-platinum-selling music producer, remixer, songwriter, and author. He has collaborated with notable artists such as Prince, Belviv DeBoe, Freddie Mercury, MC Light, Coolio, New Edition, and Seal. Wolff's contributions as a composer and producer extend to soundtracks for numerous films and television episodes, including 12 seasons of NCIS, The Sandman, Oprah, and the NFL. His influential book, In Tune, Music as the Bridge to Mindfulness, garnered attention from publications such as The New Yorker, Parade, Mindful Magazine, and Spirituality and Health. The book serves as the foundation for his podcast and YouTube channel, Wolf in Tune, which also features his R&B-based mindful soul music designed to induce a state of calm clarity in listeners. Additionally, Wolf's course at USC's Thornton School of Music explores the harmonious relationship between music, meditation, and mindfulness, making it the first university-level program of its kind to delve into how these practices can mutually enhance each other. You can find out more about Richard at his website, www.richardwolff.net. And here we are, and the music has ended, just dropping into a moment of silence. Okay, everyone. That's it for the opening monologue, and now, on with episode 45 of the CSM podcast, In Tune with Richard Wolff.
Okay. So, welcome back, everybody, to the Creativity, Spirituality, and Making a Buck podcast. Special episode with a new friend, Richard Wolff, whose nickname, I'm not sure if I'm allowed to use it yet, Wolfie, right?
Please do.
Okay, so we might allude to him as Wolfie, but we've just been chatting for a bit. We have so many areas of crossover and people we know but have never met. So this is, first of all, I just want to say welcome to the podcast, and it's great to meet you.
And it's a thrill to have been invited and to meet you.
Yeah. So, you know, we one thing that we have in common is that, we're both full-on professional into the music business, such as it is, that's been our livelihood and so forth. But we're also seriously interested in the practice of, Buddhism and mindfulness type of meditation. And so you're an active teacher in that you have a book out that's a wonderful book called In Tune, but do you run workshops and seminars with people and things like that too?
I teach at USC. I've been teaching there since 2015.
Okay. And teaching meditation.
I am teaching a course called Music and Mindfulness Strategy and Practice for an Ever-Changing Field.
Wow.
So that's it. It's about music, the connections between music, mindfulness, creativity, spirituality, and making a buck.
Well, and here's on the making the buck side, which is a light, I'm sure you understand, it's tongue-in-cheek. But right away, that part of my mind goes, that's a great topic for other music schools. I wondered if you have approached other music schools, like Berkeley would be like a no-brainer almost to introduce a course like that.
You know, here's the thing about academia and the subject of mindfulness. Mm. This is my theory. Mm. That if you're in a music department, if you're going to introduce some kind of course, it has to be something that's geared towards improving you as a musician. And that is not what I'm teaching.
I see.
I'm teaching how to improve your life mm-hmm. as a musician and as a human being. And in the course of that, if it enhances your performance and you don't have so much performance anxiety, if you're practicing better or whatever, and it pays, you know, dividends in terms of you being a better musician or being a better music industry person, beautiful. But that is not the extent of it. Whereas I know there are a few courses like mindfulness, how to be a better singer, you know. So
Right.
And I think that's how they can justify getting a course in a university. That's my theory.
Well, how did they do it at USC then?
Well, I was teaching a course, music, media, and enterprise. Mm-hmm. And part of that course, there were five subjects in the course. One was non-duality and how non-duality... It sounds funny, but
oh, it's just, you know, so you great. Can,
you yeah. can apply non-duality
yeah.
to wow. art, because, you know, you think about, you know, Nirvana. What's Nirvana? Well, it's taking punk rock on one extreme and pop, melodic pop on the other extreme, mm-hmm. and putting them together, saying, oh, they're interconnected here because they're not in, you know, these silos that are separate. And same thing with any genre where you want to talk about hip hop, you know, uh-huh. taking soul music, you know, blues and jazz,
sure.
putting it all together, taking, you know, broadening people's approach towards art and music.
Right.
So that was one subject, was non-duality. And the other one was mindfulness.
Wow.
And after teaching that for about a year and a half, the head of the department came to me and he said, you know, I think the most valuable thing you can do for students, what they really need, is you to do a course just about mindfulness and music and how they connect and how they can use their musicality
right.
to get these practices, because that's what they really, really need. So I think it was Ken Lopez, his visionary ability to see the value of this. And and I did it. And I was thinking, how am I going to do 15 weeks? I do like a little bit of mindfulness every
right.
course and some non-duality,
right.
but how am I going to make this 15 weeks? But we figured it out.
Well, you know what you do? You just write on the score, tacit.
Oh.
Like the
you
first...
want to explain that? I guess... was teaching that this last week.
I mean, it's not a bad way to explain meditation. Tacit just means be silent, you know, be still for this amount of time. It's a measured amount of time. Of course, many funny jokes about timpani players, and also, you know, the drummer taking a big drum solo, and the conductor saying, you know, don't you see what it says? It's tacit for those 12 bars. He said, oh, I thought it said take it. You know, there's a million versions and variations of that. But I don't know. For me, what you're saying, I think would be a short shot into other schools. I think this way. I'm sorry. They call me nudgy because I just completely nudge people when I have a good, an idea for them. So it just seems like it would be a short hop towards presenting something like that in the music schools, and you qualified to do it.
So, I'll tell you what we are doing though. Yeah. I'm on the board of the I Have a Dream Foundation in Los Angeles, which does many things, but one thing we do is adopt classes of children in underserved areas from third grade, and we follow them all the way to high school, and then their scholarships to college. And in 2017, I started a pilot program for music and mindfulness, but the person that was leading it left. And then we got serious about it a couple of years ago. And so we have a music and mindfulness program right now for fifth graders in Boyle Heights. And the USC Center for Mindfulness Science did a data research, and we don't have the final report yet, but the preliminary results were that people, the young kids in the fifth grade that were taking the music and mindfulness course, showed increased mindfulness, which shouldn't surprise people. Right. They spend less time on their phones and they have decreased impulsive behaviors. So there is kind of a spread of this idea, and it's on, right now on that level.
Yeah, wonderful. And there are many opportunities sort of emerging in that. You know, one of my favorite photos on our 100-hour mindfulness meditation teacher training landing page is a young graduate of our program. He's 28 years old. He started a company called Be Mindful, and he's a high school and college athletic coach. He's a tennis coach. And so it's all mindfulness training for athletes at the college level. And he's getting a lot of clients. And the picture is of 100 lacrosse champion players, you know, like the kind of champion lacrosse players from around the country gathered, and he got to present to them. And so there's 100 kids sitting in the bleachers of like a basketball court, like meditating, you know. And mm-hmm. it's just like, to me, that is... I know there is a dense niche of people presenting Buddhism and meditation these days, but the art of bringing it out to people who are not going to be necessarily steeped in it in the same way that somebody like you and I might go, oh, you can go deep into that. I think it's just a huge air landing pad right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. So now, looking at your space there, for those who are not familiar with that, what that is, that's a bunch of gold and platinum records, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah.
So could you walk us through a couple of them?
I robbed the warehouse. Well, they're mostly from the same era, which was the late 80s and the first half of the 90s. Mm-hmm. These particular plaques over here, which was, speaking of non-duality, the beginning of the combination of hip-hop with R&B.
Oh, yeah.
Because there used to be, and pop, by the mm-hmm. way. So it's hip-hop, R&B, and pop. The first record that crossed over to do that was Bell Biv DeVoe with the album Poison, okay. which I worked on. So you have the Poison up there. It was sold almost 4 million records. Okay. And the beautiful thing at the time was you had, in black music was on one side, and on the other side you had hip-hop, which was all this underground stuff. There was small little labels like Def Jam. And, sure. I don't even remember, Wild Pitch and Tommy Boy and just little street labels that were putting out hip-hop. It was not a mainstream thing. Sure. It was very underground. It was just the voice of a disenfranchised people. And those people were listening and nobody else. And even, you know, in the black music departments and record companies, they scoffed. When I brought in my artist to get signed, we didn't have the support right away of the, right. the black music department, but we had the support of other people there. And so with that, in the very, you know, with Poison, which came out in 1990, that was the first record to have hip hop and R&B and pop. It was three members of New Edition. And so they could get airplay because they had this love for them in the radio stations, especially in New York, and where it started to take fire. So that's what these plaques are. They're from that era of beginning of the R&B hip hop crossover, and there's some Latin stuff, Barrio Boys, and other stuff like that. But it's that era there.
And what was your role in some of those records? Were you producing them, writing tracks, playing?
Yeah, I was playing. I was playing guitar.
Oh, okay.
Wah-wah guitar, because I had, you know, knew how to play wah-wah guitar and funk bands and stuff like that. But I was a terrible guitar player. But when they invented sampling, if you got like 4 seconds right, you could play for 4 seconds. You sample yourself. So every chord, you know, you sample a different button. And it worked. And I also play keyboards. And my partner at the time, Brett Epic Mazur, he played drums. So we sampled his drumming. And he was a much better drummer than I was a guitar player. But so we did, you know, we wrote tracks and produced and, you know, did everything you do to make a record.
Right. And are you actively engaged with the music business in 2023? What shape does that take for you now?
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting question. Because I went through, after the 90s, in the 2000s and up till very, very recently, I was very active in television, movies and television. You know, I've done a lot of stuff in television. But I just got very, very deeply into this idea that of teaching music and mindfulness. And I had resisted writing music that I was going to claim as meditation music because I was very sensitive to the fact that music is a bridge. And I didn't want people to think, oh, I'm going to sit down. I had an Uber driver in Florida who told me he meditates. I said, how do you meditate? He says, well, I listen to Billy Joel. He's got this one song and I just play it over and over and over again. And I'm thinking, you know, from my experience, meditation, you can look at meditation. I compare it to a keyboard. And on this keyboard, you have all these different things you can accomplish. Okay. If you want to get calm and relaxed and peaceful, et cetera. Maybe you want to get clearer focus. Maybe you want to get into silent illumination. Maybe you want to get into Rigpa, you know, luminescence, primordial luminescence. Maybe you want to, you know, keep going into investigating reality. And silence is so important. I mean, silent illumination is in many schools of Zen. I mean, they say that's where you're going. That's where we're going to go. That's the destination, the silent illumination. So anyway, I didn't want people to confuse listening to music and that be the end of it. That's the end of my meditation. Okay. That's all I'm doing. And that's it. Right. I want them to know. So now I'm writing music that I built in the silence at the end. And then I come back with the music and I have guided meditations over it. And it's with R&B hip hop.
How cool. Yeah,
because
wow.
There isn't any of that going around. You have New Age, and that has its, you know, kind of genre. But I was trying to, and I am using changes and sounds from R&B and hip hop in meditation music, and that's my main project right now. That's my main focus, musically speaking.
We have. One of our young teachers, Jasmine Lamb, who's, you know, she's studied and she's learned how to be a very good, mindfulness and meditation teacher. And she made a record that had sort of more, some music in the background. We generally at Dharma, when we teach, you know, not to have music in the background when you're sitting, but it's not doctrinal. It's just sort of a sense of, you know, not trying to fill the space with too much entertainment value and try to dry out a little bit. But she did it. She made a record with a kind of soundtrack thing that was spacious and cool and had a lot of gospel element in it. And, you know, I think there's a lot of room for people to, you get the ball handed off to you in a football game. You're supposed to run with it, you know? You don't just stand there and hand it back to the person who gave it to you. So the idea of you doing that is I'm going to, of course, listen to some of that music. And maybe we could put a couple of links in our the text that accompanies this podcast to pick out a few choice ones for people to listen to. But is it easy for you to say what would be one that people could listen to check it out?
Well, I haven't officially put it out yet.
Oh, it's not even released yet.
Yeah, it's not released. I released one single basically on YouTube. I haven't released the whole project. I rethought.
Is it on YouTube right now?
Yes.
Okay, what's it called?
I forgot. I'm kidding. It's called Darker the Night, Brighter the Stars.
Yeah. Cool.
Well, that's a quote from Dostoevsky. I think it was Dostoevsky.
Oh, shit.
Don't get too excited. But yeah, Darker the Night, Brighter the Stars. Yeah. But there's no guided. It's just purely music.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and that's on YouTube. We could look at it right now. If we knew that title, we would find it.
Well, let's spend more time talking before we look at it.
Okay. No, I don't mean we're not going to look at it during the talk. I'm saying for the folks out there, you know.
Okay.
You can go check that out on your own time.
But for the full experience, you have to hear the music. I think some of the music you need to hear it with the guided meditation over it, and with the built-in and with the silence at the end.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. This sounds very intriguing. And it sounds, genuine in terms of you putting together things that are actually meaningful to you, you know, and creating your own blend, you know. Right. And that I think is going to be an interesting new area. You know, one of the things about I think you know that I studied with Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche as my teacher. Did you know that?
I'm not surprised.
Yeah.
I know you're an extremely esteemed, you and your brother, right? Ethan.
It's
right?
My son. Ethan's my son.
He's your son?
Yeah.
Holy mackerel.
Yeah.
I assumed he was your brother, of course.
Well, he's also a good friend and colleague, but he is. I did.
How beautiful.
I did be his dad, and I still am his dad, and I'm his daughter's grandfather, you know, which is one of my cherished roles these days. So,
wow.
Yeah. Yeah, but Rinpoche, Trungpa Rinpoche was a, you know, very innovative in a lot of ways. But one of them was that he was really an artist and a photographer and a, you know, a poet, and really presented, even the early days of him being here, a whole window onto a world that he called Dharma art. And if anybody wants to check it out, there's a little film you can find called Discovering Elegance. That's the title of the film. Mm-hmm. And it was an art installation in Los Angeles back in probably early, mid-70s, included flower arranging. He was, you know, very masterful in Japanese flower arranging, and also furniture and room set up. And, you know, So one of the things he said, which I kind of have taken seriously, is he said, the Dharma in the West is going to spread through culture and art. That's going to be a big vehicle for spreading the Dharma in the West. And you know, the idea of we would go with Krishnadas. We were talking about Krishnadas before this, but you know, there was that wonderful retreat in Maui, and we would do music and yoga, and some, you know, people are just convening together to share a number of different activities that have a kind of spiritual dimension to them. And I think that's I really strongly feel that's the cutting edge going forward, that and business. And then there's going to be the deep pockets of people practicing, you know, classical conventional Dharma. And that's good too. You know, you need all of it. But so that's, I'm very interested in I will definitely be attending to your output there as it comes out into the world.
Oh, great. Thank you.
It sounds intriguing. And also I this is just my impression, but I think it's fair to say that you're not just a casual peruser of Dharma and just go, oh, this is a new trendy thing. You know, this is something that's been meaningful to you for a long time, and you've studied and practiced it. So when somebody like that comes out with something, that's always interesting to check it out.
Yeah, as I said, I resisted. I mean, I got some criticism. The book came out 2019. Of course, as you know, you may not know, but I finished it in 2016, but by the time you get a publisher and the editor makes you do a year and a half re-edits and all this stuff. But some people criticized the book and said, I thought you were going to teach me how to meditate to listening to music. I thought there was music, you know, and I resisted.
Wow.
As I said, this whole idea of writing music is silence to me. You know, as a musician, we're sensitive to silence. That's the part, that's one of the parts that's so common that we have in common because of our musicality. And we're able to listen to silence and through silence get beyond sound and silence.
Well, also the space between the notes, right? The space between the notes.
It's the space around the notes, before the notes, between the notes.
And the notes themselves.
You know what really is, I think you'll like this, changed my life. And I didn't know how until I started to seriously meditate 17 years ago. I tried to meditate since I was 17 in high school. And I went to Zazen. I went to a Zen center, Zendo, and in a college, and I couldn't do it.
Yeah.
I just was not able to sit. I thought if I got distracted one time, that meant I couldn't meditate. And I tried many, many times in my life until I had a panic attack. And my therapist told me, you need to meditate 20 minutes a day, 10 minutes a night, 10 minutes a morning. And I said, I got to figure out how to do this thing.
Yeah.
This was I don't know how many years ago it is now. It's 2007. And I said, all my life, I'm trying to meditate. And then I realized, hey, because I'm a musician, I practice. And they're telling me that this is just practice, a book by Minham Rinpoche.
Mipham. Mm-hmm.
Mipham Rinpoche, training your mind to be an ally.
Right.
And he said, it's practice. You know, it's like training a horse. You just do it over and repetition. Sure. So, well, music is repetition. Music is practice. So if I take that attitude and it's okay if I get distracted, I'm just practicing not being, you know, being distracted and then not being. And I made a world of difference. I was finally able to do it.
Yeah.
And so I went off on this, you know, serious journey, and it ends, you know, and listening to silence is so important. So I was going to say what had been in the back of my mind for years since 1984 was Miles Davis. I had lunch with Miles Davis and Tommy La Puma. You know, Tommy La Puma was from Warner Brothers Records. He had signed Miles to Warner's. He was producing Miles. It was just the three of us in a restaurant. It was an hilarious time. I mean, Miles was telling us stories that I can't repeat here.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, actually, you could repeat them here because we're not on network radio or television. I don't think there's any restriction for language, for example, that I'm aware of.
Well, I don't know.
Other reasons. It's, you know.
It could be.
There are some great Miles stories about everything from a lot of people. I mean, he was, just to throw this in, and then I want you to finish. Sorry, I'm not meaning to interrupt, but there's one part in Miles' autobiography where he says, well, this guy was fatter than a motherfucker, but his wife was skinnier than a motherfucker.
Okay.
So I left the thing going, well, is a motherfucker fat or skinny? I don't know, as a unit of measurement. So, yeah, I think you can, Miles is in my world is kind of a crazy wisdom master.
Yeah.
He's an adept.
Yeah. So he had been telling these stories. One thing he said, you know where I'm going tomorrow? I said, no, I don't know where you're going tomorrow. Where are you going? He said, I'm going to the Holy Land. I said, oh yeah, what are you going to do then, Miles? He said, I'm going to do what I do best. And I said, what is that, Miles? He said, fuck. But the thing he has, he stopped telling stories and he turns to me. He stops telling the story and he just goes silent. And we're just the three of us. So we're all quiet because Miles, you know, we want to hear what Miles is saying. And Miles turns to me and he goes, you know what the most important lesson I learned ever about music? I said, no, what is it, Miles? He said, silence.
There you go.
And something hit me then. I didn't know. It's like a koan, you know, and they said koan is like a red hot ball, iron ball in your mouth, but you can't spit it out.
And you can't swallow it.
Exactly. And I never understood. What is he talking about? And I listened to the music and I understood
a
certain amount, but it wasn't until I meditated that I really understood.
Yeah. Yeah. That's beautiful. And there's, it correlates with, I probably told this anecdote before, but the first time I ever got meditation instruction was from Trungpa Rinpoche, and it was in 1970. And I was a student at Berklee College of Music at the time, and I was going to a yoga studio there. He came and did a workshop there, and then he gave each person meditation, one-to-one meditation instruction. And I got up to my interview. I knew something about it, but not really that much at that point. And I said, you know, Rinpoche, you know, is it possible you could give me a mantra? Because I'm a musician. I really like sound. And he said, he just looked at me and said, have you ever listened to the sound of silence? And I had a double take because it was a big hit, I think, on the radio, right?
Yeah.
I thought he was like yanking my chain as a songwriter or something like that. But, you know, it was his instruction right away leaned towards the more Mahamudra Dzogchen spacious style of, even though it was shamatha vipassana, it was, you know, mindfulness awareness practice. Mm-hmm. Sit up, feel your breath, go out, you know, notice when you're thinking, come back, you know, the basic fundamental instruction. But there was a feeling of like when you go out with the breath, you just let it go. So he emphasized the out breath. Mm-hmm. And then he said the in breath just happens by itself. There was a sort of gap kind of quality to it. So he was already introducing that idea of non-effort or kind of not, you know, open awareness style of meditation right from the first minute. Mm-hmm. So the sound of silence, of course, what's cool about what you're saying, and we'll all listen to your record when it comes out, is if you have somebody listening intently for a while and then you drop into silence without filling the space with applause or next cut or a commentary, that you've set the person up in a way.
Yeah. Is that the premise? Right. Yes. Yeah? Yes, you've set the person up. It's dropping them into
right.
a whole different state of consciousness, and you've prepared them.
Yeah.
Oof. I had one student tell me, by the way, that, you know, I'm finding that they have a choice to listen to the guided meditation with music or do it without music. They like the music. Mm. It's kind of, I don't know, I think Krishna Das calls it honey, right? He says with medicine, it's kind of.
Oh, yeah. The mantra is the medicine and the music is the syrup.
Yeah.
So in other words, it's like to make the medicine go down to make it
exactly.
taste better, which
exactly.
doesn't make the guys in the band and the girls in the band feel all that great about what we're doing. We're just the syrup and, you know, he's the medicine. But it's not exactly my view of what's happening in that kind of atmosphere, because I think the music has a sacred element to it just by itself. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But more mm-hmm. often for people, music is kind of, you know, you're like I asked Rinpoche once, what do you hear when you listen to music? And he said, the mind of the composer.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
You know, it's really like...
The problem. You're hearing the mind of the composer instead of just mind.
Well, I think he meant it more in the sense that it's not so much like... It's penetrating through the sound and the contouring and the shapes and the busyness of it to like you're actually feeling the kind of quality of consciousness of the person who composed the music.
Yes, that's the problem.
Yeah. Why is that a problem?
Because you're tethered to this person's agenda. Where he wants you to go instead of just being open to whatever comes across your field of experience.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's why it's a problem. Mm. It's a good thing, you know, to introduce you. It's like, you know, an appetizer.
Yeah.
Oh, get your appetite going.
Sure.
But once it's going, then you want to just have an open field, right? You want to be able to receive whatever energy field where it's going, wherever it goes.
Well, kind of into an agendaless kind of space.
Yeah,
and also not accountable or driven by one person's perspective.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah.
And by the way, just to finish the thought about the silence. So I think it was last week again. In class, I had done this guided meditation. Then there's a minute of silence. And one student said, boy, that silence really messed me up. I was, and it really messed me up. And then another student said, I had the exact opposite reaction. This is to show you that everybody is wired differently.
Sure.
But yes, the point is to prepare your mind in a certain way to be relaxed and focused and not, you know, stressed out and pressed and all that. And then listening to music and then, oh, the silence. Wow. Mm. Your palate has been prepared for an amazing taste. You know?
Well, it's like you gave them a nice rug, and then you pulled it out. Which is different than sort of just throwing somebody in space. So here's the rug. Here's, you know, and it's a little bit like, you know, tantric kind of practices where you visualize incredible you know, deities and mandalas and stuff like that. At the end, you're supposed to dissolve it, you know. I think some people think I've created a new reality or something like that, but it's actually just a kind of appearing and dissolving. And it's very comfortable with appearing and dissolving, but we're not.
Well, that sounds fascinating. I'd love to know more about that.
The idea that the all practices I've ever been exposed to in a Buddhist context is not true of everything, arise from emptiness and dissolve into it. Mm-hmm. So even if you get into a highly articulated realms of kind of, you know, beautiful qualities that are embodied by deities and, you know, things where you're conjuring up the very best aspects of who you really deeply are, none of it is meant to be solid in the way that we're used to solidifying things. So you practice emptiness, you know, just open space, like you're talking about, the silence. Then you bring up the bodhicitta, you know, the heart aspirations, so that it's for the benefit of others and you know, that you make sure your heart's in the right place doing all this. And then maybe you do, you know, the practice, and then you dissolve the whole thing into emptiness, you know, and you arise fresh. And any grasping onto that is considered not really part of the instructions.
I mean, it was so tantalizing listening to you talk about the visualization of the mantras, of the, I guess, mandalas or whatever. Yeah. What was the visualization you're talking about?
Well, in, you know, in Tantra, in Vajrayana, part of the Buddhist program.
I don't know anything about it. Yeah.
Okay. So, well, just quickly for the listeners, there's considered three yanas or three vehicles in Buddhism, three turnings of the wheel, the Hinayana, which is held up by the Theravadan kind of tradition, et cetera, extent, and then the Mahayana teachings, which are global, every Zen and
Zen,
many, many different traditions. Yeah. And then there was supposedly an after-hours class in the Buddhist time, which is you know, more inner or secret type of teaching, in which a lot of different skillful means are utilized, including using the imagination, which up to that moment you have used to conjure samsara and all the troubled kind of perceptions of reality. You use that same imagination to imagine kind of pure sacred representations, which are the deities. You've seen, I'm sure you've seen the pictures and the rupas and the forms of it. Sure. But none of them are considered to be solid. So this is where sometimes with the Hindus and the Buddhist Vajrayana, you get into a slightly different, you know, none of it is meant to be kind of think of them as solid, real beings, like the way that we think of ourselves as being. You know, they're ephemeral. They're spontaneously existing. They're made of light and energy, but so are we.
Sure.
You know, we've become dense materially. You know, but our real nature is light and energy. You know.
Yeah, energy field of consciousness.
And music.
Well, you know, musical people, they hear music wherever they go. Whatever it is, you're hearing music.
Well, Miles said that too. He said he hears music in the playground, but not saying I hear a separate kind of music. He hears that as music, he said.
Yes.
You know, just the kind of sound, mandala.
Yes.
So,
yes, that was the you mentioned Tacit. I don't know if that was before we started, right?
Right. I don't know. No, I think it was during. I don't know. I don't remember.
Yeah. So you talk about
it. No, it was during our talk because I explained it to people. I said what it meant.
So Tacit, you're telling the musicians to. I mean, John Cage, right? When he did the 4 minutes and 33 seconds of silence, the instructions to the musicians were Tacit number one, Tacit number two, and Tacit number three. Just don't play. Right. And so the point is, the audience is sitting. He was a Zen student. The audience is sitting there, and they're ready to listen to music. And what do they hear? Somebody shuffling their feet. They hear coughing. They hear the air conditioning. The idea is that's music. You know, traffic. That's music. If you're musical, every sound is music.
And remember, Frank Zappa did that thing: America Drinks and Goes Home.
No, do you what remember is that? It?
Well, Frank Zappa had one recording of jazz in a club, but he turned up the ambient sound. Like, because let's say you're in a jazz club like the Village Vanguard, you're listening from the bar, you know, you hear the music, but you hear the cash register. And so he just portrayed that reality. America Drinks Up and Goes Home. I don't know. It's probably on one of their albums, I think. But yeah, so it's interesting that we do. Well, I, if you're like me, I can't stand music in a restaurant, for example. I would rather they just didn't play anything. But usually they have terrible sound systems. All, you know, everything's below 50 hertz and loud. And then you hear the bass drum and you're trying to eat like, you know, sushi or something like that. It's stupid, you know. So so you're playing with, you know, it sounds to me like you're playing with audio chiaroscuro. Remember what chiaroscuro was? Light and shade, light and shadow.
In elementary school, I failed art. I failed.
How do you fail art? You can't fail art. Did you really?
Yeah, this is the only course I ever failed in my life. Was a sixth grade art teacher. He was the art teacher throughout my whole elementary school career.
And you got an F, literally, in
art? F, got an F.
Oh, it's deep. But light and shade, light and dark. So you're playing with sound and silence in a kind of conscious way that is, it's kind of form and emptiness. It's very Zen in a way, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Did you study Zen? Is that your training?
That's how I started when I was 17. You know,
but after
I started,
I
started reading T.D. Suzuki. I read all of his books and Alan Watts and Philip Kaplow, all the writings. And then there was, like I said, a Zendo that was around the corner from where I lived. And I used to go there and learn how to sit Zazen.
Right.
So that was kind of my upbringing in terms of, and I've always, you know, I've studied a little bit of Tibetan and I know some of the Advaita Vedanta, Sri Maharshi, and a lot of different people. But I consider Zen to be really, I don't know, my lineage. I don't have a lineage, but whatever there is empty of a lineage, it would be Zen. I mean, I still meditate. I was a Zen, who the former head of the San Diego Zen Center has a small meditation group, and I meditate with him and his wife regularly. Mm-hmm. And I love the culture. I love the stories and the poetry in the Zen culture. And I totally appreciate Suk Chen and Rigpa. Rigpa's a real thing. Mm-hmm. So there are things in Tibetan, but you know, Tibet has a culture, and there's a culture of the Chinese Chan and Zen, and the Chan really was, and Zen really attracted me.
Yeah. And have you been to Japan?
Yes, I went to Kyoto.
Yeah. I had the sort of strange karma of teaching Buddhism in Japan quite a lot, actually. I was going there 5 times a year before the pandemic hit for about 5 years. And we have a sangha there called the True Nature, and it's part of the Dharma Moon sort of umbrella. But it was intriguing for me to go to Japan and teach Buddhism. I would apologize profusely every single time before we started. But the truth is that most modern Japanese people don't practice. You know, they have a kind of cultural, probably the deepest cultural connection to Buddhism anywhere that you could find. But the average person is just, you know, would say they're Buddhist, but they wouldn't necessarily be engaged in a daily practice or something like that. Mm-hmm. It's really split off, you know, from the people running the monasteries are doing that for the culture. And it's not like they're, you know, they're coming down and saying, oh, we're having a high school gathering and we're going to teach, you know, Sazen or something like that. There's some of it, but not as much as people might think. So, you know, what are you listening to these days? Is there anything kind of did you watch the Grammys?
I did watch the Grammys, yes.
What did you think
of it? I missed the most important part, which is Kendrick Lamar getting his award. But I watched some of it, yeah, a lot of it. You're asking me what I'm listening to musically these days?
Yeah.
I'm listening to SZA's new album. I like her very much. I keep listening to Kendrick Lamar's last album. I listen to the radio, Power 106 and 92.3. But I don't focus on it like I'd like to focus. But I'm listening to it while I'm running or doing things like that. I listen to podcasts. I listen to Sam Harris. Uh-huh. But musically, Thomas Addies, some of the classical composers are going around, and I don't know, it's just a lot of different stuff. If they're playing Steve Lacy on the radio, that's what I'm listening to. I'm listening to a lot of Drake, because they play 4 or 5 of his songs constantly on if you're listening to those stations. But I mean, he's good and all that, but it's too much,
right?
And then things I don't even remember half the stuff. There's, you know, some new jazz stuff, the Snarky Puppy. Who I adore also is Robert Glasper, and anything he does and anybody he plays with. He's in this, I think, Terrence Martin you know, those musicians.
Yeah, it's.
By the way, you know, I was thinking, you know, about art and what Trungpa Rinpoche said. So, you know, Zen is spread through art, you know, mainly poetry, right?
Well, poetry and calligraphy.
Calligraphy.
Gardens, flower arranging.
Flower arrangement, yeah.
You know, Trungpa Rinpoche was into all of that. Like we had at the center in Vermont, it was a perfect example of this fusion thing. It was an old farmhouse, you know, when we started it, and then built it out, and there was a courtyard, and there was a rock garden in the courtyard in the middle of this Tibetan-ish shrine room in the middle of Vermont, in the middle of a farm territory. So, you know, how people are assembling these things these days is going to have to be a hybrid. There's like no other choice. If you want to do a pure cultural statement, I'm not sure there's one to make at this point, how you would even do that. If you're a Westerner and you're just saying, I'm just doing traditional Japanese Zen and art form, there would probably be something disingenuous about it.
Yeah.
And museum-y, you know? So
yeah.
I think the principles have to be kind of like processed, and then, you know, so how people are going to communicate. I'm assuming the underlying principles don't change. That's kind of part of where, that's why I like the classical study of it, because I don't think it's about somebody having some new discovery and thinking of a new way to talk about these kind of basic things, but how you meet people's minds where they are and how you communicate about it. And are the underlying principles the same as just the underlying principles of everyday life? Which is my assumption is that also, that business must have the same principles. Art must have the same principles. You know, truth is just the way it is the way it is, you know? Mm-hmm. So, and the beauty to me of the Buddhist thing is it's deconstructive rather than constructive. So you're getting down to, as you said, the ground situation, which is unfabricated, you know, it's unconditional. And then forms arise from that. So what, you know, I'm eternally interested in what people are doing in terms of how they're portraying their involvement with practice and bringing it out into the world. I just talked to Angie Cho on the podcast coming out, and she's a feng shui expert, you know, but she's a Korean woman who grew up in New York. It's like these cultures are really having a mashup right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing we don't have enough of is Buddhist comedians.
Well, wait a minute. What about Duncan?
Well, that's one.
It's funny because, there have been a few interested very much in Buddhism and meditation, don't you think?
Well, yeah, that's going back to Zen. That's one of the things I love about Zen is that they have such a great sense of humor. Mm-hmm. I mean, the koans and their stories, they're funny. Yeah. You know, I mean, yeah. You could just read Zen comics and have an epiphany.
Mm. Well, that's interesting. The thing about, and I have talked to Duncan Trussell about this, because I said, and it's true for actors too, and it's true for business people. You make a choice at a certain point. Like if you're a comedian, if the driving thing is it's got to be funny, and that's the measuring stick that you're using, you might find yourself at a moment where you can be connecting to a meaningful communication that's not funny necessarily.
Sure.
And then which way do you go? You know? And I guess the Dharma person would go with the Dharma even if it wasn't funny. There's, you know, so that's tricky because, you know, if we have a goal or an object, which is our measuring stick of some kind, it's hard to mix that with one with a kind of understanding that is not fundamentally agenda driven.
Mm-hmm. Well, I find it very challenging when you say the same principles apply from the absolute to the conventional or the relative. That's the toughest thing. How do you live your life, you know, when you've had a glimpse of interconnectedness and emptiness and, you know, the non-self and no division between the subject and the object, you know, when somebody's plagiarizing your song, You know, your instinct, if you're a you're practicing meditation, is, you know, you're going the way of peace, and you say, well, I don't want to, you know, but hey, you plagiarized my song, you know, I mean, what can we do? And they don't answer. I mean, at some point, what do you do? I mean, that's very difficult.
Well, that is profound. And we talk about it, and I have chosen this framework pretty explicitly. And you mentioned the absolute relative truth. Sometimes I overcook that goose. I like to talk about it so much. But in the tantric perspective, they're considered inseparable, which is a little bit of an added thing. Absolute and relative truth, you can't pull them apart.
Right. You can't.
So,
right.
So therefore, they're really intertwined. But there's a third truth, actually, which is the inseparability of the two truths is a third truth.
Yes. Yes. They're different. They're separate, but they're inseparable.
Yeah, which is like, you know, then you really have to tune up the instrument right there. Talk about keeping it in tune. That's, you know, not an easy one to kind of fake your way around. So what it shows up like in life is exactly what you're saying. You have some sense of openness, compassion, you know, caring for all beings, and somebody just ripped you off.
Yeah.
Or and drove their car over your foot, you know,
whatever. I'm sorry.
Or drove their car over your foot.
Right.
Whatever form it took.
Yeah. And then everybody around you is saying, well, but hey, they ripped you off. You can't just let it go. I mean, you know.
Well, it's not just everybody around you. You feel something too, no?
You feel something, but, you know, here's the gap between what you're feeling and not knowing what to do about it.
Yeah.
You know, and not wanting to create, you know, conflict. You know, you're peaceful, but you can't. I'm sure there are many quotes about pacifism that I don't know. Mm-hmm. And say you have to, at some point, in order to protect the pacifism, you have to, you know, be strong and whatever. I just don't know what they are. But I find that very difficult to apply the insights that you might get into ultimate reality and live your life that way. And I think it's easier if you're like you're teaching and I'm doing this music and teaching. And if you're living in that world, it's easier to navigate the two, you know.
Well, and we started DharmaMoon.com. Our company is not a nonprofit. It's a business. Uh-huh. So we run it like a business, but we're trying to run it like an ethical, you know, one. And I've looked for examples in the business creative community. And, you know, when and where has anybody cared to try to blend a kind of ethical, creative atmosphere with a successful, thriving business? And you know what I came up with, among others, is early days at A&M.
No kidding.
There's a nice TV series on it. You can see these people were artists. They were culturing and nurturing artists. They were letting them do what they do. They were making money. They were hitting it. They had a couple of chances to sell out that they didn't take, but they were in a thrive state. And then when they sold the company at the end of the day, I think to one of the big, I won't say who, but one of the big commercial labels. And they got reassurances. We're going to keep the gestalt of this company operational. We're going to keep the vibe. And within 3 months, it was over.
Mm-hmm.
It was all about the money. So, you know, I'm looking, if my holy grail is definitely a blend of what you're talking about.
It wasn't Apple Records, I think, originally.
Well, Apple was Beatles. An attempt. Yeah, that was the Beatles. And they signed James Taylor, famously, as was their first major artist.
Right.
And, you know, they were trying. There are people who've set out on the course we're talking about to create, you know, a cultured business setting in which people's creativity and honesty and, you know, kind of good nature is being respected. And it, you know, you could look at even company like Headspace within the domain of what we're doing now, you know, the meditation teaching. It got to be a size, you know, it was appealing to people because they could get a little instruction and it wasn't like a brain drain and it was accessible. And they got to, you know, size up $2 billion. You know?
Unbelievable.
So,
and fast.
Yeah. Well, and then you have to look and say, how would you preserve the culture? Mm-hmm. You know, and you look at companies like Patagonia or some, you know, companies, there are people experimenting with these models of like sort of, you know, holistic business model. That's the trick is that it's based on sort of, you know, a for-profit, you know, context rather than a nonprofit context. Mm-hmm. And it's tricky to do because people get, you know, a little whiff of like the other thing and they're gone.
Yeah. I even think that Apple computers, you know, that Steve Wozniak and Steve Jobs named it after Apple Records.
Uh-huh. They did? The
Beatles. Yes. Oh, yes.
I didn't know that. I thought they just coincided with that.
Oh, no. They named it after Apple. And matter of fact, they had to pay $500 million to Apple Records for the trademark.
Mamma mia.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And okay. I think what they started out, there was that
idealistic
idea. Yeah, ideal. You know, he said, used to say, talk about non-duality in art in the world. He said, I stand at the intersection of art and technology.
Yeah.
You know, I'm putting those two opposites together, the coincidence of opposites, Alan Watts says. Sure. I'm putting them together in a non-dualistic way. That was the, I think that's still part of the culture. That part is still there, I think.
It gets challenged when a lot of money is going down, just like in the record business.
Oh, you know,
as soon as a lot of money is going down, people come in who are experienced with that, who don't really care about the art. And, you know, I lived through, you know, you're talking about the 80s and 90s, but, you know, in the 70s, there was a lot of idealism about music in the late 60s and the 70s. Mm-hmm. And then as it became a much bigger business, which it did at that point, accountants and lawyers came in, and the next thing we all knew, they were running the companies. It wasn't mm-hmm. people like Lenny Wonka or Mo Austin or the varieties of kind of like artist friendly you know, people. So yeah, I guess it's an ongoing challenge, isn't it, in a way? And it depends what your goal is. I mean, I tried to define success in my book. There's a chapter on defining success on your own terms. And it's not necessarily about making more money than the next guy.
Oh, no.
You know, for some people it is, but I don't find that a definition of success that I can really relate to.
Well, look at the music business, and the most successful people with the highest esteem, public love and followings and awards. Michael Jackson and Prince and Elvis Presley and Kurt Cobain and Whitney Houston. I could sit here for the next half hour talking about the most successful people and how did they end up with self-destructive behavior. It didn't make them happy. And they even Whitney Houston said, money, fame, it's not making me happy. I mean, these tragedies just prove that money and fame go up to a point and then they can just, you know, turn around and just destroy people. So,
yeah, it's great to, you know, if you have a great artist, for a lot of people to hear it. And I mean, I guess I can think of, as you were saying, I'm thinking about James Taylor for a minute in my mind, who started off, you know, kind of not in a good state of mind when he started in the business, but I think kind of grew as a human being also, and, you know, still making great music. Doesn't feel leveraged by like, I gotta have a hit, you know, that whole thing,
right?
But a high standard for the quality of it. So I'm there's probably examples of the other thing too. It'd be interesting to see who we thought fit into that category.
Yeah, oh yeah. And this is one of the reasons why I was always thinking that I need to meditate, because look at the musicians that, I mean, this is not the only path, but musicians that have some kind of a spiritual practice, could be anything, could be Christianity,
right.
But the ones that Herbie Hancock, for instance,
right. good choice.
Teaches, right? He's a Buddhist teacher. Tina right. Turner, for instance, who had to come out of that abusive relationship. She's a Buddhist. The Beatles, they started this whole thing in terms of the West and bringing some awareness when they, in the 60s when they went to India. Philip Glass.
Yeah.
And right now you have, you know, Rick Rubin, you've got Kendrick Lamar, you've got J. Cole, you got Alicia Keys. I mean, one after the other, examples of musicians that have sustainable careers that are have spiritual practices. Many of them are meditative. Well, all the ones I mentioned are meditators. And that always intrigued me. How come these musicians, you know, Wayne Shorter, and they all talk about meditation. There's something there. There's some connection there. Between this kind of healthy, deep relationship in their lives to the spiritual practice and the musicianship and the fact that they're accomplished musicians.
It's a real, I call it the Rishi path. You know, it's like the worldly path, the worldly Dharma path, in which you're manifesting these principles on a very high level, but you're fully operational in the world. You're not a, you know, a renunciate kind of practitioner. Mm-hmm. Right. But it's a challenging path because you are tasting the, you know, it could be poison, it could be medicine at that point, you know?
It could be poison?
Yeah, fame could be poison, could be medicine.
Oh, you're saying that. Yes, 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 yes.
You know?
Yes.
So it takes a kind of strong-minded individual to weather the onslaught of, you know, what I guess what Buddha would call the Maras, you know, the daughters of Mara came and went. The way I explained that story when talking to a contemporary audience, I said he was sitting there and he was kind of achieving some kind of equanimity and peacefulness. And these women, the daughters of Mara, come up and say, you know, you could have a big palace, man. You could have like a big ass palace. You could have consorts. You could have a lot of money. You could have this. You could have that. And he had to kind of like not just repress it, but kind of really transform all that into something that he could see the illusory quality of it all.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, then you have this whole tradition that our tradition comes from is the Mahasiddhas. This is what Krishnadas and I and Raghu and everybody have in common. Our gurus back then were Mahasiddhas, were people engaged in the worldly way. They were not renunciates. The 84 Mahasiddhas, Talopas, one of them, he's the founder of the Kagyu school of Tibetan Buddhism. He was a yogi living on the bank of a river. So, and there was other ones who had, you know, Saraha was a arrow maker, you know, one woman was ran a brothel, you know, it goes as wide as you can go with your mind, that to live in the in a kind of manifestation level, but have the mind of a, you know, of a kind of stable adept.
Yeah.
That's a cool tradition. And it is the root of ours, actually.
Well, that's what a spiritual practice can give you. You know, I mean, they have some of these people do live in the palaces that I mentioned. Certainly, but they don't define themselves by that. You know, if you're used to being somebody that's relevant to the pop culture, like Prince was, for instance, he puts out a record. Doesn't matter you have $300 million. Doesn't matter you can tour and get 30,000 people in the stadium to come see you if your record is not on the top, you know, of people's minds. If you're, what you're creating now is not what it was. And like, what's your purpose now? You have no more purpose. And that's the problem. But if you have a spiritual practice, you understand your purpose is limitless.
Well, so Wolfie, if I could call you Wolfie, which is your nickname. Can I call you Wolfie?
Please.
That's okay.
Yeah, I love it.
You are working with young people who are coming up in and into the this arena. And you're offering them a joint, conjoined path of training in music and also training in meditation.
Well, I don't train them in music. I,
but that's part of their whole environment there, right?
That's part of that. I'm training them in how to use their musicality in terms of creating a practice for themselves, you know, a meditation practice. And also there is the aspect of creating what I call meditations on sound or compositions on sound and silence. And, you know, in the traditions of John Cage and Miles Davis and Pauline Oliveros, et cetera, it's in some of the new people now. So there is some musical, adaptations there, but the main focus is getting a practice, getting a daily practice, a contemplative practice. And then, you know, I say meditation is like a rehearsal or practicing by yourself in a solitary time with your band or your instrument. And mindfulness is how you perform on the world stage. That's when you use what you've been training.
It's really great. And you have a formulation in your book. I'm going to mention it again, and we will definitely post it up. And, you know, I'm going to easily and happily recommend it to everybody to just get a hold of this. So there's an audio book version of it for people who like to listen in tune. And very cool cover too, by the way. Can you move your right shoulder so people can see the cover?
It's a
takeoff on a Zen diagram of the stones balancing, except it's a musical note. So Did you think of that? That's kind of cool.
Oh, I know. It's the publisher.
Wow. Yeah. I think that's happening, you know. So, yeah. And you have a paradigm in there that you explore in called the 12 Bridges, right?
Yes.
So maybe could you say a little bit about what the 12 Bridges are?
Yes. So I alluded to before is when I realized that there was a connection between music and meditation, that I could actually do this if I just followed that road, and it worked right away. And the first bridge was practice. But then I saw, well, besides practice, there's patience and perseverance. There's also posture. You know, when you're a keyboard player, you know, one of the first things you learn is your posture. And when you meditate, you're taught the posture, especially when I started in Zen, right? I had a very strict Japanese patriarchal master who was very strict about it, always yelling about me one thing or another. But one thing was the posture. And this dedication. And then there's the harmony. You know, you have harmony of mind, body, feeling when you're making music. And that's the kind of thing you can experience when you're meditating. And that's the beautiful thing. When we make music, it's such a high, and we experience all these wonderful things. And then we get off the stage and we got to live our lives. And it's like we're fish out of water. Well, here is something that you can, you know, use when you're living with yourself on a day-to-day basis. And so you go to the transcending the self. And that's one of the greatest gifts of music and of meditation and mindfulness, but especially meditation, because it could be dualistic mindfulness, not so much, but non-dual mindfulness. And that's, it's not about your ego. When you're making music, it's not about you. It's about the music. If you're trying to perform, you want to just have the best performance possible. If you're writing music, you just want to take the song where the song wants to go. You want to help it go. It's not about your self-referential agenda. It's about the music. It's not about you. And so you're transcending
is
the self.
Is that the harmony bridge?
That's the transcending. It's all related, right? But, it's all inclusive.
But this number four was harmony, right?
Oh, I wasn't doing this in order. I jumped from harmony to transcending the self. Okay. I jumped over a few things because it's my favorite. But I can go back if you want to the harmony is, you know, you're physically
right
when you're making music, right? It's music is invisible and material and intangible, but yet it has very material consequence. It can make you nod your head and snap your fingers. So it's physical, but it's also emotional. It can move you to tears, move you to that, whatever. And it's mental, right? And so is meditation. When you're really deeply in samadhi or in meditation, it's a physical thing. You know, you're experiencing something with your entire body. Somebody said it's not mindfulness, it's bodyfulness, they should call it. You know, you're
in the four foundations of mindfulness, you have mindfulness, the body is the first one.
Exactly. So you can relate as a musician, you can relate to this harmony, this integration of your mind, body, feeling in these states of meditation. And there's mindful listening, deep listening. Of course, that for us musicians, this is key, is that we are highly attuned to listen discernibly to all these different aspects of sound, whether it's timbre, tempo, frequency, you name it. We're listening so intently. Why not use that talent to focus when you listen to the environment, to listen to everything around you, to listen to your inner voice, your inner sound, and your inner silence.
Richard, could you identify the 12 bridges that you just for people to identify what you're talking about?
Okay,
then,
that was
then they can go in depth in the book.
Oh, it's, you mean just name them?
Yeah, but in the naming of it, I think there's a certain recognition people will have. Okay. I'm like, oh, okay, he's correlating this and that together, and it makes sense to me.
Okay, and so there's deep listening. I should go to the book. I'm sure I know all of the.
I'm kidding.
The sympathetic vibrations. There's transcending the self.
Okay.
There's trance, and I would have to explain what that is.
Okay.
And then there's silence.
Right. So these are, I think, you know, what I noticed just from, you know, looking through that is that you took 12 things that any musician could identify, and you went, you could take these same principles, is what we were talking about earlier, and bring them over to the practice of meditation, and it's going to give you a bridge. Yes. Maybe it's been tricky for you to think about meditation because you don't have a bridge to cross to get to it. But these 12 things any musician would identify and say, oh, yes. Okay, now I'm making correlation here between what I know and what I'm about to learn.
Yes, that's been my mission. I realized that because of my musicality, after 50 odd years of trying to do this and not being able to do this, but once I realized, hey, they're related, they're not separate. This, you already have the sensibilities and skills as a musician in this one practice to port that over to this other practice. When I realized that, that became my mission, to let musical people know that they can do this. Practice could be so beneficial to them.
Right. You built a bridge.
The bridge was there. I was just showing. I was just saying, hey, well, look at this.
Yeah, I mean, it's... for athletes, for example, they have another way of looking at principles that govern their activity. And this is something that we've been just finding is people will make the trip into these traditions and then they build a bridge back to people who are your family, your kin, your tribe, whatever you want to call it. And you have illuminated a bridge where they can take what's familiar to them already and portal it over into something that is going to be a whole nother open up a whole nother dimension for them.
Yeah.
Anyhow, I'm going to just say that, like, I feel really, I feel comfortable recommending the book to anybody. But I think of the musicians who are out there, this is well thought out here, Richard. That, in my humble opinion, it's not just like, oh, I knew this and then I knew that, so I put them together. No, this is very almost. Well, it's precise, but it almost like really gives you footholds. It's like if it's rock climbing, it gives you footholds that are well thought out, well spaced, well placed. And I think that anybody who's been wanting to learn how to meditate, who is a musician, I know some musician friends of mine, they go, I don't know how to, they said exactly what you said. In fact, a very famous saxophone player I just worked with said, yeah, I can't meditate because I can't quiet my mind. Mm-hmm. And you know, you could talk to your blue in the face, but if you put it in terms that somebody's familiar with you, you give them a short hop onto it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I want to not steal too much of your life and time because this was a wonderful getting to know you session. And if there's anything that, you know, we want to let people know about, depending on when the podcast probably will be coming out in a couple of months because we have a kind of backed up. So I don't know when your record's going to drop or you know, when that's coming, but we'll be in touch with you about it. And I just want to thank you so much for taking time out of your obviously very productive and busy life and sharing some of your journey with us here.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me. It's been sincerely a sensation.
Okay.
And incandescent. Yeah. Finally meeting you after hearing about. By the way, I just got to say, I was in the audience when you got an award, a BMI award, for the most played music. I was in the audience. I remember
ASCAP.
Hearing.
Yeah, it was an ASCAP award.
Oh, it was ASCAP? Okay, it was ASCAP.
No offense I
was
to in BMI, the, but yeah.
You what?
No offense to BMI, but
no
I,
offense
I was
to BMI, ASCAP. But you won an award. Yeah. You remember that? I'm sure you won many
I
awards,
do.
But that night I was in the audience and it made an impression on me.
Parallel universe.
Yeah. And that was years ago. I don't know how many years ago that was.
Yeah. And, you know, we've woven, I think we're similar in that we've woven in and out of the traffic in the music business, the film and the television and the record world, and not completely ensnared by it. That's, I think, something we have in common. We're trying to, you know, have a genuine interest in it and relate to it. And but, you know, some people are just caught up in it to the point where they don't have any other access to another way of looking at anything. Mm-hmm. So we have an ongoing conversation, Wolfie, and we'll I hope this isn't the last time we get to talk about it. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
There you have it, folks. Episode number 45 of the Creativity, Spirituality, and Making a Buck podcast on the Be Here Now Network with David Nickturn and our special guest, Richard Wolf. We'd like to extend a huge thank you to Richard for taking the time to generously join us in conversation. And we would like to thank all of you for listening. We hope that you enjoy this podcast as much and more than we enjoy making it, and that it has a positive impact on your life. We encourage everybody to head over to the show notes or wherever you need to go to pick up a copy of Richard's book. And also, there should be links to Discovering Elegance, the Trungpa Rinpoche short film about Dharma art. And head over to YouTube and check out Richard's work, Darker the Night, Brighter the Stars. So, you know, we would like to thank you and encourage you to, subscribe on YouTube, give us a follow, give us a thumbs up on, share on your social media platforms, give us an 11-star review on your pod platform to help us get the word out about the podcast. Also, it's currently the end of July 2023, and I'm gearing up to get the podcast back into a steady rhythm after some disruption. So please feel free to reach out to me at michaelk@dharmamoon.com if you have any suggestions for what you'd like to hear us talk about on the podcast. And that's it. All that arises dissipates, and this podcast is no different. So one more time, thank you for listening, and may you be safe, healthy, happy, and at ease. All the best, precious ones.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest? Are you holding on to secrets, fears, or frustrations? We all carry around different stressors, both big and small. Don't keep it all bottled up inside. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's also a great way to learn to resolve conflict, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/beherenow.